advocated for Israeli annexation of the occupied West Bank. In 2015, he said there were plenty of territories outside of Palestine where a Palestinian state could be established. In 2017, he said there's no such thing as an occupation. Huckabee is a Christian Zionist who has led evangelical Christian tours of Israel. Huckabee declined to repeat some of his extreme views on Israel and Palestine, repeating that he would represent Trump administration policies. I'm Eileen Alfandary.
I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel Diaz. When we in the DMV, you know we're listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features voices of conscience, courage, and resistance. Africa Now is next. Welcome to the show, Muizu Mtali. The music in the background is Conundrum by Kasiba Mutua. As we come near to the end of Women's History Month, Africa Now goes into its archive and highlights the voices of conscience, courage, and resistance of Dr. Wangari Maathai, Gloria Luando, and Professor Sonia Sanchez. We begin with an interview of Dr. Wangari Maathai, the founder of the Green Belt Movement of Kenya, the first environmentalist and the first African woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize. This coming April 1st, Wangari Maathai, who joined the ancestors on September 25, 2011, would have been 85 years old. The show presents a conversation between WPFW's former public affairs director, Gloria Minot, and Dr. Wangari Maathai on October 7, 2008. Here is the conversation.
Your work. The Nobel Academy in Oslo decided that you deserved a peace prize, and so you were honored, and we share your joy. It started out in such a simple way. You didn't have the mathematical geniuses behind you. You didn't have the world's great scientists behind you. It was just a small idea that just changed the way the environment is viewed. Would you talk to us about how your effort began to rid your country of the plague, may I say, of deforestation?
Yeah. I would say that quite often in our life, we don't realize how we grow up, the environment in which we grow up, in our parents, our teachers, how much they influence our thinking, our values, and how our life is eventually shaped. And I'm quite sure I'm very much a product of all that, including a product of the fact that I ended up in this United States of America at a time when especially the black people were trying to change the laws of this country in order to realize the freedoms that are promised by the Constitution of the United States of America. And I was here as a student in a small college known then as the Benedictine or Mount St. Scholastica College. Now it's known as the Benedictine College. And when I went back to my country, I wasn't going to start a movement. I wanted to go back, contribute to development of the newly emerged nation called Kenya. And I joined the University of Nairobi, intending to be an academic member. But I also wanted to be involved in what was then emerging as global women's movement, where there was a lot of awareness encouraging women to get involved, to challenge the status quo at that time. And indeed, in the University of Nairobi, there were only three of us, two of whom qualified to join the academic members of staff. And it was very difficult for the university to give us the same terms of service as the men. And so we had to struggle. And that was the beginning of what eventually became advocacy in me, where I tried to challenge so many fronts where women did not have a stand, where women had no door to get through. And it was in the course of that that I joined the National Council of Women of Kenya as a representative of the Kenya Association of University Women, the few of us who were there, both academic and non-academic. And at that particular time, the United Nations had just decided, this is now in the early 70s, it had decided to have a United Nations conference, the very first one, conference on women. And it was that conference, which was held in Mexico in 1975, that declared the Women's Decade, which went between 1975 and 1985. And during the preparation of that meeting, as we came together as women of Kenya and tried to identify the issues that we would take with us to Mexico, it was then that I interacted very closely with women from the countryside. And these women were not talking about the rights, such as I was as a member of staff in the University of Nairobi. They were talking about very basic needs: the need for clean drinking water, the need for food, adequate and nutritious food, the need for an income, to have money in their pockets, and the need to stop soil erosion on their farms, the need for firewood, which was the main source of energy at household level. And when I listened to these women, it became clear to me that they were talking about an environment that I knew as a child, but which had all these needs met. And so I started asking myself, so what happened to that environment that I knew as a child, that now the people living in the same environment do not have clean water, food, firewood, and they're poor. They're saying they're very poor. And to cut a long story short, I eventually learned to make the link between what we do to our environment and how we govern ourselves. If we have good governments, responsible governments, accountable governments, governments that think about the welfare of their people, they can take care of the environment. They can ensure that the resources we have within our borders are managed responsibly and accountably, and they can facilitate equitable distribution of those resources. If they don't, then we have a lot of poverty, we have injustices, we have violations of human rights, we have disrespect for the diversity that is in every community. And eventually, those who are marginalized, those who are denied justice, whether it is political or economic, eventually seek that justice. And when they do seek that justice, sometimes it comes with conflict, with wars, whether they are civil wars, regional wars, or even global wars. And if you look all over the world and think of any conflict that you know of today, they are all over the resources. Who will access these resources, and who will be denied access? Who will control these resources, and who will be outside the control? Who will receive these resources equitably, and who will not be allowed to receive these resources equitably? Whether we are fighting over land, over water, over oil, it is all over resources. And that is what the Norwegian Nobel Committee recognized in our work and decided to use it to bring this issue to the world so that we may understand as a people, as a human species, that it is time to change the mindset of how we look at resources on the planet and how we manage those resources. Because in the future, in a world which continues to have 6 billion people and still rising, in a world where resources are finite, we need to change our mindset so that we may learn how we can preempt conflicts in future.
And along that line, we also must recognize, as you have, that women are the key to the realization of some of these things. When it comes to war, when it comes to women being left outside of the mainstream, we can see what happens. In wars, women are used as a weapon of war. War is something that they're always fighting. You look around the globe and you can see how women are affected. Talk to us about how you started this movement and your experience as a woman in being the founder of Kenya's Green Belt Movement. What were some of the challenges you faced?
Well, when I first started, as I said, it was a very benign response to very basic needs in a community that I knew very well since I was a child. And I never thought that I would be in confrontation with the authorities. But it became so, partly because eventually I discovered that governments need to be controlled. And governments are controlled by institutions that are created by constitutions. So the basis is you have to have a basic constitution that guarantees freedoms, such as the freedom of association, of expression, of the press, respect for human rights. If you do not have a constitution that guarantees this, they can be very easily violated by leaders. And I confronted that. And when I tried to stop this and to say that our government must respect these basic freedoms, I was projected as an anti-government person. And the movement was presented as an anti-government organization. And so eventually we found ourselves in jail. We found ourselves being beaten in the streets, being humiliated, and being projected as people who were not wanted in the country. Yet we were doing the right things. So what I learned eventually is that people in power can be very disrespectful, especially of women, of the poor people, because women are marginalized. Practically throughout the world, women are marginalized. So when a woman rises and presents a challenge, she's met with contempt, she's met with humiliation, and she's met with no respect whatsoever. And I found myself being treated as if I didn't matter. And that really annoyed me a lot and in many ways gave me the energy. And I'm partly saying that because I know that there must be many women in that situation all over the world. But it is very important for us to realize that women, as people who give life to the next generation and who raise the next generation, we must resist that temptation to isolate us, to deny us the opportunity for decision-making in how our countries are governed, and also refuse to be used as tools of war. Recently, Jody Williams, who is the Nobel Peace Laureate, who got her Nobel Peace Award as a result of her fight to stop the landmines, she and also another lady you may know, actress Mia Farrow, who has been very committed to the work, to the issues that are going on in Darfur, in Sudan.
Yes.
We recently visited that area. We went to Chad because we were not allowed to go to Darfur region. So we went to the border, between Chad and Darfur, and visited the refugees in those camps. And many of them were women and children because the men are involved in the wars. And when we went in there, it was just amazing when we listened to the stories of how women are used as a weapon of war, especially by rape. And men ought to be embarrassed ashamed of themselves that they should use such vulnerable people as women and children and rape them so as to get an advantage in the war. And what I have seen since I started and tried to rise either in the academic levels or try to draw attention to the need for better governance in my country, and even sometimes tried to just ask for the basic freedoms of people. And when you go to a war front such as Chad and Darfur, you see that time and time again, women are misused, are violated, because they are, I don't know how men perceive women, because especially when men start using women as weapons of war, violating the bodies of women so as to annoy, so as to hurt, so as to humiliate the men on the other side. It is so unfortunate, and sometimes you just don't know how to react.
Mm-hmm. How did it feel? Again, here's a first for you. How does it feel being the first East African woman to complete a PhD? That must have been quite challenging.
Well, that was a very important step in my life, because at that time, as I said earlier, there were very few women going through school. And I was lucky to have come to the United States of America, where I did my bachelor and my master's. So when I went back and I wanted to teach in the university, I had to register in order to get a PhD. Now, I got the PhD in 1971 from the hands of Jomo Kenyatta, who was our first president. So it was a big accomplishment for me. And I was extremely encouraged by the fact that I could do it. And at the time I was doing it, I was already married, and I was actually expecting my second child.
And Jomo Kenyatta, let's tell our listening audience about the role of Jomo Kenyatta in freeing Kenyans from the shackles of colonialism.
Well, Kenyatta was a man who was lucky to have traveled to Britain in the 40s, and who studied in Britain, and he had a period that he spent in Moscow. He did a PhD, he did a first degree in anthropology, and so he came to understand the role that culture and identity and self-empowerment and self-knowledge, how these are important in giving people a sense of who they are. And so when he came back to Kenya, he joined hands with especially the men who had returned from the Second World War, men who had fought in the British, along with the British Army. But when they came home, they found themselves completely not being recognized or thanked for having fought in the war. And instead, they saw the British soldiers, the white British soldiers, being given their land. In other words, their own land was being taken away from them.
And these are the men who fought in the war.
And these are the men who fought in the war. And their land was being given to the white soldiers as a gift by the British. And they were not given anything, not even any recognition, no monuments to speak about. And this actually inspired them to start the Mau Mau struggle, which many people associate with murder and rape and a lot of other atrocities, which were propaganda to a very large extent, that were propagated throughout the world to present this struggle not as a freedom struggle, not as a struggle for the black people to find dignity and to end colonialism, but instead it was being projected as barbaric, murderous uprising by a primitive tribal group. Well, Kenyatta was one of those men who provided the leadership, but as we all know now in history, he later on denied having provided the leadership, and in fact he died without denying that fact. And sometimes when history is revisited, sometimes people think that he indeed may have sacrificed his values and his convictions later on in life. He may have been persuaded that if he can deny involvement in the movement and deny connections with the people who he had previously led, he would be given an opportunity to become the president of the country. Now, these are issues that I'm sure one day will be unraveled by historians, but it was very interesting that when Kenyatta became the president of the country, he literally abandoned the people who had fought for freedom and instead rewarded people who had fought alongside the British as collaborators. And that's why some people feel that he indeed may have sacrificed his comrades in favor of collaborators in order for him to become the first president of the country.
That was a conversation between WPFW's former public affairs director, Gloria Marinot, and Dr. Wangari Maathai, and that was featured on October 7, 2008. And we pulled that from our archives as we continue to highlight the voices of conscious courage and resistance as we come near to the end of Women's History Month. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. The music in the background is Kurima by Chinewiso Marere. And now we continue to go to our archives to highlight voices of conscious courage and resistance as we commemorate Women's History Month. Now we're going to feature the voice of filmmaker Gloria Lorando. And here's a conversation we had a few years ago with filmmaker Gloria Lorando.
We want to spotlight award-winning Afro-Cuban filmmaker Gloria Lorando. For over 35 years, Gloria Lorando has documented the African experience in Cuba, at the same time connecting it with the rest of the Caribbean and the Americas with films such as Ogun, The Eternal Present, My Footsteps in Baragua, a film about the history in Cuba of the Caribbean community from Jamaica, Barbados, and other parts, and Eyes of the Rainbow, a film of Asata Sakur, and 1912, Breaking the Silence, chapters 1 to 3, a documentary series of the 1912 massacre of over 6,000 members of the Independence of Color, the first black political party outside Haiti, and Reshipment, the story of forced repatriation of Haitian immigrants in the early 20th century who came to work in the sugarcane fields. Executive producer James Pope and I had a conversation with the renowned Cuban filmmaker Gloria Lorando when she visited Sankofa in Washington, D.C. Here's the conversation we had with the Cuban director.
All right, so we wanted to start with this interview here with Gloria Lorando. And one of the things that I wanted to start this interview off as like a bookend question is if you were to try to summarize the purpose of your work, what would that be? If you could summarize like the purpose, what do you think that would be?
I have been working as film director and all my things are related with our histories as a black person. History of migration, history of family history, silence. and everything comes, you know, through my interest, commitment, and knowledge about the Caribbean literature, Cuban history, Caribbean history. So everything is related around our history that sometimes doesn't appear exactly in the official history. And also, the main source for me is the collective memory, the memories of the people. This is the first step for my work.
So do you see your purpose as being a modern-day griot storyteller?
Exactly.
Of resistance for mm-hmm. the African people?
Yes, yeah. Because when you talk, would you get in touch with some people that live in Cuba, especially the elders, somebody that was born in Jamaica and arrived to Cuba in 1926 or in the 30s. What means that? What kind of history are behind these people? How did they get here? For what reason? When you find the historical information and in the newspaper and make consult with the historian, you realize that you are in the presence of one of the main characters of this huge history that maybe appear in the historical information as one number, you know, or la emigración, the migration of Jamaicans. And that person was born in Barbados, Trinidad, St. Kitts, Montserrat, or some cases that the people, they were born in Panama because their relative arrived to Panama to work at the Panama Canal and remain there and never return to their island of origin. They went to Cuba, that in that moment, because the sugar industry needed cheap labor force, they called the people, go to Cuba. There were a lot of promotion. So it's fascinating for me when I met these people that were los protagonistas that kind of history.
So it's basically you're making a historical context real. You're putting a living face on it, because we tend to think that history's linear, that it happened there, and it doesn't have a continuum along it.
See, and also it's the history that connect the Caribbean countries. Sometimes we speak Spanish, others speak English, others speak French, but we have many things in common. More in common than things that separate us.
Interesting when James said that you put a living face to it. I want to be your three-part series about 1912. Mm-hmm. Focuses a lot on the independent party of color, which your grandmother was one of the founding members of that party.
No, it's not like that. The history of the independent party of color, the history of the struggle of the black people since the slavery time, until the beginning of the 20th century, when after fighting for the independence of Cuba, they decided to organize their own political party because they didn't see, you know, the construction of the idea because they were fighting for many years. So I made this in three parts in order to go step by step, explaining for what reason black people need a political party. What happened with the foundation of the party in 1908, the program, who were the members of the Independent Party of Color, who was Evaristo Estenós and Pedro Ibonet, who were the main two leaders of the Independent Party of Color. And of course, all the problems and the attack that suffered the Independent Party of Color, especially after during the year of 1910, until 1912. So I have to divide these three episodes, you know, in order that the people little by little get in touch with the topics and make an analysis, because also it's the life and the political and historical contribution of the black people in Cuba.
And how does your grandmother play it?
I don't know how you related one thing with another. I made a fiction history related that is called The Roots of My Heart. In The Roots of My Heart is a fiction history where Mercedes, black woman in the present, she wants to know the relationship with the grandfathers that is a silent. You know, in the African diaspora, there are a lot of silent people. They don't talk. They ignore or they want to keep in silence because it was very painful. So it's a fiction history, it's a love history. And Mercedes, the main character, she discovered that the grand-grandfather disappeared during the massacre of 1912. Mm-hmm. But it's a fiction history, basic in history, that who knows how many history of like this happened in 1912, where they destroyed and broke so many black families.
Let me ask you this. Documenting the socio-political or the cultural or historical experiences of African descent people, And it's a very powerful tool tracing this history and making these connections. Do you feel that this work that you're doing is a form of resistance? Do you feel that this work is a countering the dominant narrative of the historical experiences? So do you you see what I'm saying? Like, it's, do you feel that?
Mira, you made a film, and after the connotation that have the film is the people. It's not the filmmaker. You have a proposal. You work a lot. And the idea that emerge with the film is the people and the history who evaluate these kind of things. I don't think that any filmmaker can make, I made this because I selected this topic, but the evaluation, you're asking me about the evaluation and the resistance, is somebody who has to read this in the film, honestly.
And that goes into a very, very important question. I was looking at the perspectives because there's themes.
But also, talking sometimes about the past, you get the tools to understand much better the present. This is totally different, you know? It's, you can make your own interpretation. And that's exactly what a film could pretend to do, but not necessarily it could happen. Some people, they say, oh, I don't have any connection, I don't have any kind of... But many times, especially this documentary that we saw today, this kind of abuse and market with a human being is still alive. It's still alive. We are talking about the past. It doesn't happen in Cuba, but happen all around the world. And especially with people of the third world countries.
And I think one of the things that, just following what James was talking about and also what you're saying, how is your films taken in the Cuban context and beyond in the Caribbean? How are people...
Well, Reshipment, Reembarque, it was very recent release in Cuba. We had the premiere in Havana Cinema, and the people, they accepted very well. And they have another screenings in Camagüey, in the province that belong to the eastern part of the island. So, and they showed it in the Cuban cinema. According to our little resources, you know, they try to spread the news, and if you see Reembarque, you could get a lot of information, and it's something that happened many interviews in radio, TV program, and the diffusion was good. And now the film will participate in the cinema festival, Latino Film Festival in Havana in December. And I was invited to present the film in Haiti, because Haiti that have the International Book Fair, and the film was selected to present the film in the International Book Fair of Haiti, that it will be dedicated to Cuba. So this film will narrate a chapter on the connection between Haiti and Cuba. Bueno, Reshipment is a documentary about the presence of the Haitians in Cuba, about how they get Cuba at the beginning of the 20th century, because it's a migration that the film, you know, talk specifically beginning of the 20th century, when Cuba became a big factory of for elaborate sugar for the international market during the First World War. And they need cheap labor force, and they call all the Caribbeans to go to Cuba. And Cuba at that moment was like the promised land, because the propaganda that the American companies made and other Cuban companies made attract the people. And because they have the U.S. intervention in 1915, and they have a lot of economic problems in the rest of the Caribbean, they went to Cuba with the hope, you know, to get a better life. They have a big dream.
So obviously it's a big business.
Exactly.
Yeah, right.
And it's something that mentioned not only the Haitian historian, the Cuban historian, both sides, they agree that it was a market. And also some of the people that I interviewed they remember that their father used to have, you know, this kind of business with the people who own the land, that they need the people, Haitians and everybody, to cut cane. So it was like, you know, between two sides, the exploitation of many of our ancestors.
And it's a story which is not often recounted, especially here in the in this part of the Americas.
You don't listen very much.
We don't hear. No, we don't hear.
You don't
much
hear very much about this.
About the migration between Cuba and the other Caribbean islands. That they've always been integrated. They've always been having exchanges of ideas and issues.
Sí.
Yeah. And it's very important. I don't know if you want to elaborate on
bueno,
that.
Bueno, it's very important because in Cuba, you have many people, many black people, that they have English names. Smith, Browns, where is the origin? And also, what is the origin of those who arrived from Haiti? But it's true that in the case of Haitians, they suffer so much that even sometimes they change the name. Because the people that came from Jamaica, Barbados, they arrived with a British passport. They established a kind of distinction. Of course, they were black, they were poor. You know, when they don't want them, they send them back to their island of origin. But it's true that because they were subjects of the crown, and the Haitians doesn't arrive without passport and any kind of protection, they play, you know, with them as they want.
This story is very fascinating within the political climate of here in the United States as well, with the idea of demonizing individuals who are coming to this country, calling them illegal aliens and all these other particular things that is happening. I mean, so this history is very, very important, the continuities. The points of continuities are very important. Moving further along, one of the things that we don't want to hold you too long, but one of the things that I think that is that we probably can end with is, what are some of the ways that you're engaging with younger, aspiring storytellers?
They need to know our history. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I have been in lectures here in film school, I said, it's important that you get a good technology for your work, but how are you going to use the technology? The technology is just not to play with the technology. It's just, the filmmaker need to know history, philosophy, music, everything. Their culture, to have a commitment and identity. How can you do a film just without any commitment, any ideas or sense of identity? This is the first. For at least this is what I learned, because I never went to a film school. I studied music, I studied art history, and when I finished art history in 1976, a long time ago, the Institute of Cuban Film, they need people with general culture to work. And that's how I start, doing research, learning, trying to get the editing room to see how the different director, the style, how they did the editing. But that was my school. I never went to a film school. We didn't have at that time. So what I learned is that I need to know about about the war, and to have a commitment, and to feel part of the history as a human being, and as a woman, and as a black person. Se acabó.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you
very much.
And that was our conversation from our archives with Gloria Lorando as we continue to commemorate Women's History Month with voices of conscious courage and resistance from our archive. The music in the background is Lekela Mwadi by Shala Mwana. Now African Now features a brief discussion by Professor Sonia Sanchez, poet, playwright, activist, seminal figure in the 1960s Black Arts Movement, mentor to generations of poets and hip-hop artists. The conversation took place on August 19, 2016, soon after the screening of Bad Sonia Sanchez. Also in the conversation is the director of the film, Sabrina Gordon, and the moderator is Diarra Ndao Spech, co-founder and co-director of the African Diaspora International Film Festival. Here is Professor Sonia Sanchez.
I see I have the same thing on tonight that I had on. I guess I should follow what my children say. You need to go out and buy some new clothes, Mom. How are you doing? We thank you so much for coming out. We really do appreciate it. And we want to thank our dear sister here, you know, for all the work they did. I was not the best subject, probably, if you come through, see, you got to come through some kind of movement. We came through the civil rights movement initially, and that meant simply that you did not talk about yourself. You know, I'm serious about this. You know, you did not talk about yourself all the time. You didn't do that. And so when they began to talk about doing a documentary, I knew that I had to talk about myself. And I kept saying, well, I said to everyone, I'll let you know. And then they came back and I said, I'll let you know. And then one night I was talking to Mungu and Marani, and I was saying simply, you know, there are too many important people out there who've done so much, right? And simply, they should be going out doing, you know, work on people, you know, like that. I mean, people have died and no one has even remembered them. Although I must admit, being a part of Black Studies and being in a place called the Schomburg, that we were able to rescue people, you know, from obscurity. I mean, I really mean that. You have no idea of what it was to teach Du Bois the souls of Black folk, you know, and Zora Neale Hurston, the Oswald. You have no idea what that did to teach some of them, the earlier people who talked about change, who talked about that we were a Black nation within a nation. You have no idea what that was. And my students would say, I mean, that's like modern, isn't it? And I said, no, that happened many years ago to write about Harriet Tubman, you know, to write about all of these people, but above all, to embrace people who come before, who had lived, and who, in their time, had done the work. So it made me understand that in my time, our time, we had to do the work, because nothing changes unless you work. And I have come, every time I come to Washington, I think of a sister who came up to me and said, Sonia, I see you're still doing this stuff. You know, you're still talking the talk. And I said, well, what are you doing in the midst of this madness here? And she said, I'm making money. And I said, I hope you're sharing some of that with some people who need it to be shared. My children said to me once, you know, during those years when those sneakers were costing so much money, remember? About, what, $250, $300, and they said, we want these sneakers. I said, well, we can't afford those sneakers. And they said, well, we live in this big house, you know. And I said, come on upstairs with me. And I don't know if they remember this. And on my desk, I had, you know, the bills that I paid. And the first name that I sent money to a place called New York was a colleague of mine who couldn't teach again, had been whiteballed in a place called America, in New York City at least. And I said, before I do anything, I send money to that family with some other professors, some other people in the movement, so, you know, they can live and that family stays together. That's what I call a guaranteed income for him. But MLK talked about a long time ago, which we should go back to, you know, and talk about a guaranteed income for people in this place called America. And I said, so that's why we can't, I'm not buying, you know, $250 sneaks, and but we can get some that would cost maybe $59.95 or something like that. My children thought I was, you know, out of my head, you know, because everybody else had that. But the point, what I'm saying, you know, and I'm so grateful that you did the film, because my children did say, Mom, people need to know how you survived. They were right. That you cannot engage people in struggle unless you also let them understand that it is possible to survive, you know. You know, you're not going to do it as well as the other people, right? You know, you're not going to have a lot of friends. You're going to have a lot of people going to get mad at you, you know? And I had a bunch of them from family on to a lot of people. You had students who would stand up in class and say, I don't know about this Professor Sanchez, right? You know, and then you would see them years later at a place called the Schomburg when I was talking, and they would come up and say, you were right. Because they had dealt with America, even though they had an Amherst diploma. Because one thing about America, it will say, come on, come on, come on. I'm going to let you make lots of money. And then 50 years later, you won't have a penny. You know, and then all of a sudden you come back and say, oh, by God, about you, it is difficult. Yes, it is difficult.
That's so true. That's so true, Professor Sanchez. And I'd like to ask you, if you may, give a moment to Sabrina to talk to us about the work that she did making the film. If you could, for a few minutes, tell us about how you came into this project and also the challenge of editing, because you're also the editor for the film, correct? Not just the filmmaker. So please tell us.
So, you know, Sonia had told me the story about, you know, sending money to a colleague of hers and saying that ultimately that the reason why she agreed to make the film was because she felt like she wanted to tell the story for all the women in particular who won't get to tell their stories, who didn't get to do the things that maybe that Sonia got to do. And so I thought, I never realized until you told me that story how close we came to, like, not making the film. So I was really, like, really appreciative and really moved by that, because even in the making of this film, it's still Sonia giving to us, you know? So in terms of making the film, I mean, I won't get into the details about, like, how we finally, like, came together, but I was working, briefly, I was working with a filmmaking team in Philadelphia where Sonia was poet laureate, Barbara Addy and Janet Goldwater, their filmmaking team in Philadelphia, and I was working on a project with them, and they happened to be friends with a composer that was also working with Sonia, and he mentioned to her that he had some funding or something to make a project about Sonia, and then so they approached me and asked me, like, do you know who Sonia Sanchez is? I'm like, yeah, I know who Sonia Sanchez is, and asked if I wanted to be part of making the film. And for me, you know, there was really no hesitation about, you know, being part of hopefully making a definitive biography about this amazing poet. And I think about her own, like, personal connection, I mean, my personal connection to her work and discovering her work when I was, like, maybe in seventh grade or something. I wasn't being taught it, but I found it on a library shelf, and I was kind of floored by what I read up until that moment. I'd never read, you know, anything quite like it. I was very surprised by, you know, the frankness of it, the boldness of it, the sort of, like, confrontational quality of it. And I was like, I didn't know people could talk like this or say these things. And it also, you know, made me think a lot. It also gave voice to things that I was already thinking about, like, why the world is, like, the way it is. So this was, like, at a very formative time in my life. So anyway, I saw that to say that I was just really honored to, you know, finally to meet her and to be able to be part of telling her story. In terms of putting the film together, I mean, she's been doing this work for a really long time, and it's like, what do we keep in the story? What do we keep out? What can we include? You want to get all the sort of, like, the facts straight on a very basic level, but you also want people to walk away feeling that they know not just the artist, not just the teacher, not just the activist, but the woman. So, and also I think, you know, we were talking a little bit about how, you know, when people perform, for example, you know, people always hear, you know, get the applause and think like it's just like a really great kind of fabulous life being a poet and traveling and so on. But, you know, she sacrificed, obviously, as you can see in the film, quite a bit. So I think ultimately it was really important to convey how much, like, doing this work costs, that it's not just this thing that you just decide one day you wake up and you just do. It's a choice that you make over and over and that you reassert, like, over and over again. And it comes at a cost. And so I felt like that was important for people to, like, to appreciate. I think, you know, one of the things that there are two things I really wanted to do in the making, in putting the film together. One was, I really wanted to introduce, I think because so many people know you, as an activist, I think there was, like, an expectation that it would be all about activism, even though within the context of poetry. But I felt like no one ever really got to see you in process, like seeing her write and seeing how she goes through her process of writing. So I really wanted to open the film with that scene when she's like talking to herself and writing and humming and making those strange noises and all that. I felt like it's a way to like enter her, the mind of an artist, and then kind of like take you from there. And I think also the other people reading her poetry gave us an opportunity to kind of like break out of a sort of chronological telling of the story by having us go in and out of Sonia's story through her work, as opposed to saying, well, this happened and this happened and this happened, that we're able to be a little bit more fluid with it, which is why like we don't really learn the details of like her children until actually later in the film, because we sort of like are brought there through her work, not necessarily through like a chronological telling. It's available through California Newsreel, and you can just Google it, and there's like there's educational copies available, and also for individuals, like the average price of a DVD or streaming copy. It's still, you know, we're still showing it around the country at festivals, and it aired on PBS in March on International Women's Day in honor of Sonia, March 8th, I believe. So I know we have a few more broadcasts, you know, with PBS, so I'm sure it'll be on again. But again, California Newsreel is how you can get the film.
Okay, and fortunately, it's all the time we have for this program.
And that was a brief discussion by Professor Sonia Sanchez, which took place in August 2016 after the screening of the film Bad Sonia Sanchez on the opening night of the annual African Diaspora International Film Festival, DC. Also in the brief conversation was the director of the film, Sabrina Smith Gordon, and the moderator was Diarra Ndao Spech, who is the co-founder and co-director of the African Diaspora International Film Festival. And earlier on in the show, which we featured voices of conscious courage and resistance, we featured a conversation from the archives between the environmentalist and Nobel Peace Prize recipient, Dr. Wangari Maathai, and WPFW's former public affairs director, Gloria Minot. And that conversation took place in October 2008. Also in the show was the conversation we had, that's African Isles executive producer and co-host James Pope and myself had, with filmmaker Gloria Lorando in 2015. The music in the background is Number One by Patrice Rushen. That's it for African Hour for today. I'm your host, Muiza Muntali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shahanana with Zain Al-Amin, looking at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, with a particular spotlight on the plight of Palestinians. And that's followed by the women's collective, Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by The Browder File with Tony Browder. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Kombitla Kai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on X, formerly Twitter. That's at Africa Now Online. Also, Africa Now is archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nicella and Clea Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Koza and Funan Gonda, and our Africa World Now Project collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Erdison. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. I'll continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We leave you the closing song, Think, by Aretha Franklin, remembering her birthday, which is March 25th, and also commemorating Women's History Month. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week.
and stay safe.
WPFW News in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. President Donald Trump signed a sweeping order yesterday seeking broad changes to how elections are run. Among its provisions, the order mandates changes to the federal voter registration form by requiring prospective voters to provide proof of citizenship, such as a U.S. passport or birth certificate. Voting rights advocates argue that it could disenfranchise millions of eligible voters who lack readily available proof of citizenship. The order also requires that all ballots must be received by Election Day, an attempt to override states that allow mail ballots that are postmarked by Election Date to be received afterward. It is unclear how enforceable the order is, given that the Constitution gives authority over elections to the states. In other news, Tulsi Gabbard, the National Intelligence Director, and John Ratcliffe, the head of the CIA, faced a grilling today by Democrats on the House Intelligence Committee. Both were part of a group chat about a military operation that included the top editor of The Atlantic. Today's hearing came just hours after The Atlantic published the full text of a Signal group chat among senior administration national security officials, revealing that Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth shared precise details of military operations against Yemen's Houthis. The chat logs indicate that Hegseth provided exact times of warplane launches, strike packages, and targets before the aircraft were airborne. Agreeing with previous statements from President Trump, Gabbard and Ratcliffe today continued to insist that no classified information was sent in the group chat, while Democrats cited executive orders and internal government guidance to argue that the operational details should have been considered highly classified. In news from Gaza, the head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees warned today that the tight Israeli blockade on the entry of humanitarian supplies into the Gaza Strip is pushing the territory closer to an acute hunger crisis. Israel has banned the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza since March 4th. In a statement, the UNRWA director, Philip Lazzarini, said, quote, basic supplies are running out, and some will last only for a few more days unless aid shipments are allowed in, close quote. Lazzarini called for the siege to be lifted and for humanitarian aid and commercial supplies to be brought into Gaza uninterrupted and at scale. In other news, Florida's efforts to crack down on employers who hire undocumented immigrants have presented a problem for businesses who cannot find enough workers willing to fill low-wage and often undesirable jobs. To fix the problem, the state's legislature has advanced a bill that would loosen child